Thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of Principle of Hospitality, the podcast. Now, we've had a collision of worlds, a joining of forces, a banding of brothers. Sash from Principle Design and me, Sean from Open Pantry Consulting, are pleased to announce this venture for 2021, Principle of Hospitality. Now, we know that food brings people together and promotes community. And at Principle of Hospitality, we are here to disrupt current perceptions of what the hospitality industry can achieve in today's ever-evolving and challenging environment. Now, that's why we've partnered with Chef's Hat on this Principle of Hospitality podcast. Now, if you didn't know, Chef's Hat is the largest family-owned and operated hospitality supplier in Australia. They strive to inspire cooks, chefs, bakers, and bartenders to deliver the best product with the best tools every day. So that's why we're so proud to partner with Chef's Hat, where the industry shops. Now let's get into today's podcast. I think you're really gonna enjoy it. Welcome to another Principle of Hospitality podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. Stomping Ground is a neighborhood brewery bringing together people over great beer with Victorian locations in Moorabbin, which is opening in May, Melbourne Airport, and their home base here in Collingwood, where we're recording today. It's so easy to see how they're bringing together people over great beer. Stomping Ground has built a reputation for being some of the best independent beers in the market, with a focus on sustainability, collaboration, and fun. So it's a privilege to sit down with one of the founders of Stomping Ground today, Justin Joyner. Hey, Justin, how are you?
Very well, thanks, Sean. Thanks for having me.
Mate, it is an absolute pleasure to be here. We are here on St. Patrick's Day. I'm glad I didn't think of that before we actually did the podcast. So it's awesome to have, you know, the background and hearing, you know, hearing people enjoying their beer as we're here. Let's talk about how you started out in the industry, because I know there is a depth there, and whenever we talk to anyone in beer, it's always a fantastic story. So do you want to give us a bit of an insight?
Yeah, well, it is, I guess it is a bit of a tale. I think from a hospitality perspective, I can probably go back as far as when I was 16 serving popcorn at a suburban cinema complex. My love for pubs probably started, food and bev hospitality probably started in the summer of 98, 99 when went down to Sorrento and did a summer at the Conti Hotel down there and did everything from picking up glasses to serving beers to washing dishes to everything. A mate of mine from school's cousin owned it at the time.
Right.
And I really felt the buzz of hospitality down there. I mean, my love for pubs probably predated that, if I'm honest. I think that I have vivid memories of being a really young kid and walking past a pub and just smelling the stale beer and the cigarettes and and hearing the sort of buzz that, from inside, and just I just felt like they were magical places that I wanted to go. And for our family, it wasn't a common thing to go to the pub, but on the times that we did and we had some fish and chips or some sort of counter meal, it was just such an exciting place to be. And I don't think I ever really lost that excitement about pubs particularly, but hospitality generally. So I went down and did that summer at the Conti and had a lot of fun. And it was just before I headed off to the UK for the sort of fairly traditional 2 years backpacking through the UK and Europe. And over there, I actually, my first job in the UK was just outside of Stratford-upon-Avon in the Midlands, Shakespeare country, in a big sort of beautiful country English pub. And it was a great introduction to the English pub scene, and it's a pub scene that still, I think, is probably head and shoulders above most places in the world, just for its culture and its heritage and everything that goes along with it. And this pub was a big venue, 16th century, so low ceilings, a big outdoor terrace space, food-led, so probably about 40% of the business was food.
Right.
A typical big Sunday lunch, that sort of thing. And it was there that I kind of really understood what that buzz of working in hospitality is, to do a massive service with a crew of mates, essentially.
Yeah.
The place was staffed almost entirely by backpackers. It was outside of London, but they'd recruited everyone from London. So there were It was run by a big burly Zimbabwean guy who was a real old school sort of traditional publican who mm-hmm. knew everyone's name and really was a bit of an inspiration around the place mm-hmm. and then staffed by Australians and Kiwis and South Africans and Italians and it was a lot of fun. It was just this beautiful countryside venue with a helipad out the front. And
wow.
Literally Sunday lunch, there'd be half a dozen helicopters on the front lawn. These like little two-seaters for all these wealthy people from English sort of countryside just to fly in. And it was just a great experience. And I started there as a bartender when I just arrived in London with no money.
Yep.
And ended up actually running the place briefly as a 21-year-old.
Wow.
Just through a sequence of events with I was an assistant manager for the last sort of 3 or 4 months and ended up taking over when the manager left for a few months. Way too young to be running a venue of that size at the time and way too inexperienced, but it was a steep learning curve and as I said, it was kind of that introduction to that big sort of hospo vibe, that rush that you get with a big service and the camaraderie that comes in a team. But I also learned things, moving my way up through the sort of management ranks, I did learn about things like stock takes. I learned about things like looking after real ales in the cellar and the importance of food and then the style of this publican, Grant, his name was to know everyone's name and know their drink and
that
real
of that.
Sort of old school, you know, my pub is an extension of, is like a lounge room and you're all welcome in my venue and that really struck me and has stayed with me since then, really.
Yeah.
From there, I went to London for the second year of my 2-year visa over there and worked most of the time in a restaurant in St. James's Place just off Piccadilly there, which was probably way too flash for someone like me at the time working there. But once again, probably 2/3 of the staff were backpackers and it was as much about the party as it was the work. But it was a modern European menu and a really amazing fit out. It was an old bank with a big glass elevator they'd put in the middle and a mezzanine floor for functions and then a basement restaurant doing sort of Asian fusion. And then the middle level, which was the main kind of old banking hall, was this modern European food with a lounge and people smoking cigars. And it was a beautiful place.
Yeah.
And it was owned by a guy called Peter Gladwin, who was quite a sort of significant chef around London at the time. He had a catering company that used to cater for things like the Queen's birthday, like literally her birthday, not just a public holiday.
Right.
It's sort of a Harry the Hirer type thing for the elite over there, as well as 3 or 4 restaurants. And this was one of those. And another amazing experience and some great people through there that probably learned a little bit about wine lists and cocktails and that sort of thing that I hadn't been exposed to back here or in previous jobs. And again, there's a lot there that I sort of took with me and really relished that sort of learning opportunity, I guess.
Yeah, right. So then you've come back to Australia after a 2-year visa?
Yeah, so I came back in mid-2001.
Okay.
And I was a bit unsure at that stage what I wanted to do. I was pretty sure it was going to be something in hospitality.
Yep.
But I hadn't really settled on anything at that stage. But I wanted to... What I did know is that the experience that I'd had over there in working my way up to a venue manager role in a pub wasn't going to cut it here in terms of a role at that level. And so I sort of set about starting at the beginning here and really learning how things worked and trying to get back up to that sort of venue manager role as quickly as I could.
Yeah.
And so I started at what is now the Crafty Squire in Russell Street, which was then... It was just in the process of changing from a venue called the Red Ant, which was before that a strip club, but it had phased out of its strip club phase and into a new venue called the Red Ant, which was owned by Lion Nathan. And at that time they'd bought 46 pubs in Melbourne. And it was their first sort of big foray into the Melbourne market, trying to sell their beers and essentially Tui's New mainly, but then beers like Tui's Extra Dry, Hahn Premium.
Yep.
James Squire started coming into it shortly after that. It was their strategy at the time was to buy key pubs in key areas, Brunswick Street, Clarendon Street in South Melbourne, CBD, and Chapel Street, and really force feed Victoria, Lion Nathan Beers. And so I was part of that sort of movement. And that venue, quickly after I started, went from the Red Ant to its original name, which was the Portland Hotel.
Right.
And at that point, Lion put a what is now the James Squire Brewhouse in there as well. So they put the brewery in, and that was really a turning point for me in terms of interest in craft beer and learning about beer. Because I'd being the bogan that I was, I'd spent 2 years in Europe drinking Foster's and come back and missed all the opportunities over there of drinking the great beers that were available and came back and then learned about the beers. And so I had to go back later on to enjoy the great beers of Europe. But so the brewery went in 2001. Again, there was a few name changes before they settled on the James Squire Brewhouse concept.
Okay.
And there was a couple of really influential people there that I learned a lot off about beer. And they were the brewers, Doug Donnellan and Michael Comedon, who was quite senior at the Malt Trouble Brewery in Sydney, and they'd fly down once a fortnight to brew the beers at the Portland as well.
Yeah.
And through that experience, it was just a massive awakening in terms of what beer could be, how it actually was made, the ingredients, touching and feeling and getting involved with the brewing.
Yeah.
And they brewed a stout, ironically, Michael was Irish, so it's ironic that we're doing this on St. Patrick's Day, but they brewed a stout called the Crack, C-R-A-I-C.
Yep.
That's really just changed my perspective on beer forever. I just couldn't believe that something could be so delicious. And I never really went back. I think right up until that moment, I was drinking, Carlton Draft and other mainstream lagers.
Yeah.
And it was at that point I thought, wow, there's a whole world out there that needs exploring. And that's what I sort of started to do.
Can you remember what you loved about it the most, that particular beer? What the taste was that really got you?
Yeah, well, it was basically what we call a milk stout. So it had a bit of lactose in it. It was quite sweet. And it was just a beautiful, creamy kind of stout. And I'd always, like, I'd been to the Guinness Brewery and not really enjoyed Guinness, which was a massive faux pas. But it was, just an extraordinarily complex beer as well. There was just so much to it.
And
I guess being in the brewery and watching it watching the process and being a part of that as well kind of added to the whole experience.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I also, that was part of a time where the craft brewing scene in Australia was just really starting to take off, I guess. It was still, there's about 700 breweries in Australia now.
Yeah.
At that time, there would have been less than 50. And that, we're talking 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But Doug and Michael, while they were brewing, people from all over the industry used to come in and see them from other breweries and that sort of thing. So I got introduced to all these brewers, some of whom are still brewing, the likes of Brad Rogers at Stone and Wood, Paul Holgate, these sort of guys that were brewing way back then, craft beer that and new and interesting styles that hadn't been sort of seen before in Melbourne. Mm-hmm. And so it was not just a kind of awakening experience for the actual beers. It was more just seeing this industry and they all just seemed like great people, and everyone got along and they were collaborating and they were helping each other out. And I immediately wanted to be part of the brewing industry as well as the hospitality industry.
Yeah, right. So what did you do after that? So you've obviously, done this time at the Red Ant.
Yeah, yeah. So the Red Ant became the Portland Hotel with the James Squire Brewhouse.
It
was HMC, which was the company that Lion set up to operate all those pubs in Melbourne, was sold to a group called Open Door Pub Company.
Yes.
Which was later again sold to Australian Venue Company.
Yes.
And when it was, so I was there for 5 years in the end. And so starting off doing a couple of shifts a week on the bar and ended up the venue manager for the last two and a half of those years.
Right.
And then worked at another couple of venues for Open Door Pub Co. Mm-hmm. Before a rep came in I was working at the Exchange Hotel in Port Melbourne.
Yep.
Looking after it for a mate while he went to the Rugby World Cup in 2007.
Okay.
And my Lion rep came in and said, what are you doing next? Because I had just been away for a while and I was just having a bit of a break and I didn't know what I was going to be doing. And she said, well, you should meet this guy, Steve. He's opening this bar in St Kilda.
Right.
And it's a crazy idea. It's going to be 20 different beers on tap and it's like nothing Melbourne's ever seen and you'd be perfect for it. You love beer. You should give him a call.
Mm-hmm.
So I did give him a call and then got an email back from him saying, come, let's catch up. And CC'd on that email was Guy Greenstone, who had also been a rep of mine when I was at the Portland,
right.
And I knew him quite well. So I started feeling relatively confident about the situation.
Yes.
And these are the two guys that are now my business partners in Stomping Ground. So
right.
That was kind of the beginning of our working together, which was 14 years ago now.
Yeah, right.
And so they hired me as their first venue manager for the local tap house in St Kilda.
Yes.
Which was a beer bar doing beer in a way that really hadn't been done in Melbourne, possibly Australia, but definitely not in Melbourne at that stage. Like I said, we're talking about maybe 50 breweries in Australia at the time. And it was like you had to go and find enough beers to kind of fill the taps on a regular basis, especially if you wanted to rotate different beers through each tap. So the concept was 20 beers. It was as many different styles as possible on tap at any one time. So at the time, we were starting to see big venues in the city with 20 taps, but you'd go in there and there'd be eight pale lagers. You'd have all the usual suspects, and then you'd have a Guinness and maybe there might be a pale ale if you're lucky, or a wheat beer or something like that. But the concept for the local tap house was to have a Saison on there and some Belgian beers represented and some German styles represented and then an American IPA. And really that broad range. And then to get the best example of each style that we could possibly get either internationally or preferably locally. There was probably a fair bit for some of the more out there styles, I guess there was probably more leaning to the international stuff because that's where the standard was being set at the time. So lots of American beers coming in. And at the time, the range would, we would look back now at that tap list to begin with and think it was quite commercial in the terms of there was a couple of James Squires on there, there was some Coopers on there, there was the big sort of Belgian beers, Hoegaarden, Leff, that sort of thing. So it would look quite commercial now, but that was what we needed to do to get that breadth of styles, which is what we wanted. And we wanted people, really one of the key things we wanted people to be doing is to come in and be educated enough to be ordering a beer by style. So in the same way that people were going to wine bars and asking for a Chardonnay, we wanted people to come in and ask for a stout or a porter or a Saison or a wheat beer or what have you. So because at that time, people were going in and having a pot of heavy or a pot of light, probably.
Yes.
So it was kind of...
It's pretty
basic. Yeah, we really wanted to empower the staff with information and training and be able to impart that knowledge onto the punters to give them the opportunity to sort of explore different styles and discover new things when it came to beer.
Yeah.
But all while not being wankers about it is one of the things that we used to drill into the staff. We wanted to be enthusiastic about it without shoving it down people's throat.
Yes.
And we wanted a really integral part of the whole concept was that if you wanted to come in and drink a top shelf whiskey with Pepsi in it, you were just as welcome as someone that wants to sit at the end of the bar and talk about barrel aged barley wines for 2 hours. You know what I mean? And it had to be that. Otherwise, we would just be snobs, beer snobs.
Yeah, some elitist kind of bar.
Yeah.
So how did Stomping Ground come about? You're obviously talking about the two partners, you know, knowing them with Local Tap House. Was Local Tap House the last thing you did before Stomping Ground came on board?
No, so the Local Tap House opened in February 2008.
Yeah.
Then the Local Tap House in Darlinghurst in Sydney opened 12 months after that.
Right.
Which we've since sold. We sold that in 2017 to focus on Stomping Ground.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to be tested on dates here, but around about 2011, one of the things we used to do at the Local Tap House quarterly is were called Spectaculars, and they were themed beer festivals at the venue. So 20 beers on tap, preferably beers that hadn't been tasted by anyone ever before. But if they had, it was still a list of rare stuff that we could put on, and it might be a American Independence Day theme, so all the beers were American, or Oktoberfest was one. There was one that was all about hoppy beers, that sort of thing. And in, I think it was 2011, in January, we the festival that we decided to do was the Great Australian Beer Spectacular, which was essentially asking 20 brewers from around Australia to brew a beer specifically for the event, a brand new beer. It just had to be, that was kind of the rules.
Wow.
And that was the birth of Gab's Beer Festival, which is now Sydney, Melbourne, Auckland, Brisbane, 40 or 50,000 people or whatever it is. So it was run at the same time in Melbourne and Sydney on that day, and there were queues down the street for people to get in. The one in Melbourne, we had just about everybody who was anyone in the brewing industry was there, and it was like we just felt like something had really started. And immediately after that, or it might have even been on the same day, Steve Jeffers, one of my partners, was like, we need a bigger boat. And he was literally on the phone to the Royal Exhibition Building the next morning and had penciled in a date for the following year.
Wow.
And that's what became Gabs. So that was, and in the early, probably the first, I think, 4 years of that, I was the ops manager for them for that. Mm-hmm. It ended up outgrowing the kind of backyard operation that it was at the beginning with us with us squeezing the whole sort of operation of it into the last month or so before it happened, and progressed to now what is a pretty sophisticated operation. And and Steve and Guy actually sold that event in 2019 again, to focus a bit more on Stomping Ground. So, that began sort of around about 2011, and then by that stage, we were having conversations about what we might do next, and there was a couple of ideas there. And the plan always was, from that point, when there was the next thing, that I would come on board as a partner. So there was a big beer hall concept for the CBD that nearly got up, but for a variety of reasons didn't end up happening. And then around about probably 2013, 2014, we started conceiving the idea of Stomping Ground. And Steve was living in the US for about a year at that time, and he was sort of looking at what was happening over there. Guy and I were having similar sort of feelings here, and inspired by places like Little Creatures in Fremantle, the Guinness Brewery in Dublin, we saw an opportunity in Melbourne to bring our hospitality background to a brewing brew pub type model.
Yes.
And most of the breweries at the time in Melbourne had a small component of food, or they were open for only limited hours or whatever. So the idea of doing the full 7 day lunch and dinner hospitality offer at a brewery wasn't really being done at the time. So that was where we saw our skills lying, and where we saw a big opportunity. And then, so we started looking for sites at that point, which was a long journey in itself. And we nearly had a site around here around the corner here in Rupert Street.
Yeah.
Fortunately, it fell over because it was about half the size of this this site.
Yes.
So that wouldn't have worked out very well.
No.
And then this came up, and we walked in, and we just knew that this was it.
Yes.
A massive sort of warehouse space that's
beautiful.
Had beautiful bones, and we didn't need to do a lot to the building. We just needed, to fit it out, and put the brewery in, and away we go.
Yeah. So how have you felt the challenges of last year? If we're going to fast forward to like last year and the pandemic, and you've got this amazing venue, which probably seats, I'd imagine, over sort of 200, 250 people roughly.
Yeah. Depends who's asking, but about 250. Yeah.
About 250. So it's a big, beautiful building, obviously built to have experiences in it. Then you've got a pandemic in which you can't open. We're obviously in Victoria, which had over 100 days of not being able to trade. You know, as we were just saying before the podcast, we still can't trade more than 50% of occupancy. What were the challenges for you last year? How did you work through that together as the three of you as founders?
It was a massive challenge. That's for sure. I think in thinking about our chat today, last night, I was looking through some of the stuff that was going on at around about that time, and it was actually this day last year that I stood in front of our heads of department and said, you know, things are not looking good here. Look, this was one of the things that we wanted to do in the right at the start is be as honest and transparent as we could, and and give people as much information as early as we could.
Sure.
So I was reading what I wrote on this day last night, and it was pretty dramatic. It was sort of the lights are off at the casinos in Vegas, you know, the island's waking up to St. Patrick's Day with no pubs, and we're staring down the barrel of the whole hospitality industry being shut down. It hadn't been shut at that point, but it was kind of preparing people for the worst. And I think from there, it was about managing our people to the best of our ability and just making sure they were okay. That was first and foremost in our minds. I mean, our initial instinct when the shutdown happened, which was sort of about a week from now last year, our initial instinct was to want to do as much as we could to look after people, keep paying them for a little while if we had to, that sort of thing. And we had to, we went through some pretty marathon board meetings to try and resolve what the actual best path forward was. And I think we kept coming back to the best thing we can do for our people is have a business at the end of it that can re-employ them. Mm-hmm. And we had to look at everything through that lens because the viability of the business was paramount. We had 101 people that we employed at that point.
Wow.
And we, the three of us, felt such a huge responsibility towards them. It was that week leading up to the shutdown was just such a brutal, emotional week, having to deliver the news to people that there's no pit of money in the bank for this type of kind of outcome that we could just start dishing out. We had to all just bunker down. This is the days before JobKeeper has been announced, so everyone was so uncertain about what the future was going to hold. And we resolved to do a few things very early in the piece, just to kind of support people, I guess. So the first thing we thought we'll keep a couple of chefs on and we'll cook meals for people for our people. And so we committed to making sure that no one or their families that needed it was going to go without a hot meal each day. So we had chefs here cooking up, you know, huge batches of food, and people could just come and grab it when they needed it.
Yeah.
And if they, you know, if they had dependents and that sort of thing, they were more than welcome as well. We set up a sort of a hardship fund for people that were really in dire straits. We wanted to ensure that you know, that no one was ever in a situation where whether it was possible they wouldn't have a roof over their head or something like that. The three of us went immediately took zero wages as well in sort of as much for the viability of the business as it was just in solidarity of we're all in this and we're not we need to kind of support each other as much as we can.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think the final piece of it was providing support in the form of information for people. There was so much happening in the news and so much sort of that you could read, and not all of it was accurate or correct in terms of where to go for resources or what you're eligible for or what, you know, where to turn when it came to landlords and utility companies and that sort of stuff. So we did things like we wrote letters that people could download to send to their landlords and to their utility companies to say this is our situation, that this employee works for Stomping Ground. We're unable to pay them because of the lockdown, et cetera, just so that part of the process was kind of done for them. And then we set up a page on our website, which was kind of an internal page where any kind of relevant information for employees was there as a resource for them. And we tapped into a lot of other people that were providing great information at the time, people like Michael from Worksmith, who was just amazing through that phase. Their website was just incredible in terms of accurate information.
Yeah.
Danny Vallant was another one that was providing lots of stuff that we used as a resource. We wanted to kind of not leave any sort of stone unturned, that people had the information they needed and it was accurate. And that information was also informing decisions that we were making as well, in terms of you know, how to proceed with people standing down to 0 hours or you know, JobKeeper, introducing JobKeeper, all that sort of stuff tied into it.
Yeah. One question I've been asking a lot of people who have had venues who have been on the podcast the last 6 or 12 months He's like, what did you learn about your team during that time? I mean, you've got 101 staff. You guys are in dire straits. You're trying to communicate quickly. Everything's changing. You've got a team which you need to look after. I'm sure there were a couple of things that surprised you about the team in a really positive way during that time. Do you want to explain a couple of those things?
Yeah, well, I mean, people were people were just incredible, to be honest. Like, we were doing what we could, but there were people actually just off their own bat going over and above as well. We had a small crew of about three people here that put together what they called a staple pack.
Right.
And they basically, through our chefs, ordered some food, and then through we donated some beer to it, and it was basically for $20 or $25 you could get a week's worth of food, essentially, in terms of they'd get a chunk of meat in there and a kilo of rice and a some other sort of staple, some tea and coffee. They'd make some cocktails and put them in vacuum sealed bags and throw those in there, and then they'd come in their own time and put those together. And so that was available to people as well, and just for the cost of it, which was pretty minimal. So, like I said, $20-$25. And I think just on top of that, all of our people, I mean, we did towards the sort of second half of things, a couple of people did move on to other things because we could only give them, you know, a limited amount of hours, and for their own reasons, they needed full-time hours, and they took other opportunities. But most people stayed, and to a person, they were just, they let us know how grateful they were for how we'd handled things, but they also were just positive sort of influences around the place, and looking out for each other and realizing that you know, just how dire things were for everybody, but chipping in with time or whatever to kind of help everyone through. And I think one thing that we saw throughout the whole year is that everybody was on a bit of a roller coaster in how they were feeling about things and where they were at emotionally, and not everyone was in the same spot at the same time. Some people were really up and about at times where others were really battling, and I think through that, people were able to support each other as much as we were able to support them, and we ended up getting through in pretty good shape. I think if you had told us this week last year that we were going to be sitting here today and have most of our people retain and still have a business, I think we would have taken it at a heartbeat for sure.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
Yeah.
Do you think it's been beneficial for you to have like the other two boys as founders with you to share that burden, to share that load during such a tough time, rather than just if this was, you know, just your business, Justin, and, you know, you were the only person stomping around and you had to, you know, deal with all that pain that was coming through? Like, I'm sure it must have been a really emotional time for the three of you together.
Yeah, absolutely. And 100%. I think that's true of our working relationship over sort of 13 years anyway. Yeah. I think the kind of magic of it, for want of a better word, is that we complement each other so well. And we, you know, I think the pandemic is an example of that, that we weren't all in great shape the whole time, but combined, we were. And that's usually the case. We have our differences and our disagreements along the way, but usually the whatever it takes to get to the outcome is worth it, because the outcome's pretty good.
Yeah.
And I think, but to answer your question a little bit more directly, I can't imagine doing it by myself in that situation. I mean, the responsibility that we felt at the beginning for our people, I think, was enough to bear when we were splitting it three ways. And like to have that, you know, individually, I think would be a real challenge.
Yeah, for sure. Can we talk about independence for a minute? Because like talking about the evolution of craft beer in the last 20 years, and we were talking with another person we know in beer yesterday about the last 10 years and how it's moved from sort of, you know, 100 craft breweries to, like, you know, as you said, sort of 500, 600, 700, 800 breweries in Australia at the moment. Like, is it tough at the moment with so much different kinds of beer on the market and sort of staying relevant and front of mind in this craft brewery space that we're living in Australia?
Yeah, I think it is. I think, but I think each kind of, era has its own challenges, I guess. I mean, you probably talk to people that were around when there was only 50 breweries, and they tell you they'd tell you there was only three pubs selling their beer as well.
Because that's a good point.
Because most people had their taps sewn up by the big guys. So there is more. I mean, you walk into a supermarket alcohol outlet, and you can just see the range, and so that didn't exist before either. So some of it is offset a little bit by that, but. But it's definitely a challenge. Standing out is difficult, and it's finding ways, I guess, to resonate with people. And for us, that's through experiences. It's through not just getting people into the beer hall, but also at events and other things. It's and offering, I think, something that is accessible to people as well and widely appealing, not just beers we like to drink, but beers that hopefully everyone would like to drink, regardless of how into beer or not they are. But certainly there are some challenges. And I think you've just got to realise that you can't compete on a lot of fronts. Like, you're not going to be able to compete on price, because someone will always be able to be cheaper. You're not even going to be able to compete, you know, with marketing necessarily, because someone's always got a bigger marketing budget and can put a bigger billboard up or do whatever. So it's got to be something else that resonates with people. And for us, being really community focused plays into that a lot as well, and really engaging with different communities outside of just the beer bubble, if you like.
And
We have partnerships with the likes of Movember, Scarf, which are an amazing organisation.
Awesome organisation,
And even sporting organisations as well. The Brunswick Zebras is a soccer club up the road that we're connected with, and a few other partnerships as well that are really important to us and give us a real connection to the community, I guess.
Yeah. Has it been important to do things like, obviously, I saw on the website the Collingwood Beer Trail with other breweries that you've got in the area, and obviously the skate parties which you've had here as well. Like, is it important to do different things that are quite unusual in a way, but very important to the brand in order to make sure that you actually are relevant?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is that's a really important part of what we do. And again, it's reaching outside of the beer bubbles. It's not just a beer festival, or it's or not just a beer event. It is more a community event, I guess.
Yes.
And through that, you sort of there's other markets to be able to get to through those partnerships as well, I guess.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Just going back to last year as well for a minute. Obviously, you had a situation here where you couldn't trade this place for over 100 days. Did it make you think about different revenue streams within Stomping Ground, and do you think that some of those things will continue to stay on and continue to be important parts of the brand evolution?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first thing that we did was to get our beer onto our online store. We already had an online store, but it was very rudimentary. I mean, arguably it's still very rudimentary, but...
I think it's pretty good.
At least it's got beer on it now. So we set that up pretty quickly, but that wasn't without its challenges either, because none of us had ever done e-com before. And, you know, we were expecting some of our team, who are hospitality people, to be packing boxes and doing stuff that is probably not that attractive to someone who likes serving people and really interacting with people.
Mm-hmm.
At a time when, you know, everyone was locked in their houses, and so there was a lot of trepidation about even leaving the house. So, so it wasn't without its challenges, but it was a significant revenue stream immediately for us. And it was, I think, mainly born from the support that people want, that local support that people wanted to give to local businesses.
Yes.
So it's something that has endured, and we are still doing it. It's obviously at a much reduced level now than now that you can go to a bottle shop.
Mm-hmm.
But we're now starting to have conversations about how we can now maximise that or use it a little bit better than perhaps we did. What we've done previously is probably based on demand, and now we're starting to have some conversations about how we can attract a few more people to that channel, be it through subscriptions or exclusive beers potentially, or something else that gives them a reason to buy the beer directly from us. And a lot of people resonate with the concept of something that's come direct from the brewery, regardless yes. Of whether it's fresher or not, than something that's in the bottle shop. There is that perception that I think is attractive to people. And I think habits in general have just shifted towards that
e-com, local mindset.
E-com and local, yeah, both those, definitely.
Do you think that's going to continue to resonate, that sort of local feeling? Like we actually talked about that with Michael this morning when we recorded a podcast with him about the hope that people will continue to go back to restaurants to maybe buy another, you know, another revenue stream that they've done in their restaurant rather than go to the supermarket and that kind of thing, or, you know, making sure they're coming to Stomping Ground and actually buying their beer from here or buying it through your website rather than buying it from somewhere else. Are you thinking that's going to continue on?
Yeah, I think it will. Yeah. To what extent, I'm not sure, but I think that hyper-local kind of movement is now, there's no turning back from it. I think there's... the groundswell is now so large, and I think you're seeing with some breweries in the States focusing more on their local patch than more broadly.
Yes.
Here in Australia, Stone & Wood have always done it, despite the fact they're the biggest independent brewery in the country and they are national. Their backyard is still heavily protected and looked after by them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of informed our strategy on that front as well in really focusing on Melbourne and Victoria.
Sure.
And because we think that's where... what people are wanting at the moment.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's just beer. I think it's bread and cheese and everything else that they... I think that support for local and feeling like you have a bit more understanding of where it's coming from rather than just pulling something off a supermarket shelf.
You're
actually buying it from someone whose story you know something about.
There's a connection.
You trust their ethics and you feel more comfortable making that purchase, I think.
Yeah, for sure. Couple more questions before we wrap up today. I really want to talk about the Moorabbin site. Obviously, you've got here in Collingwood, you've got Melbourne Airport and then Moorabbin. Like, what made you guys want to do that Moorabbin site and how's that different to this site in Collingwood?
Well, we see our venues as a real crucial part of our overall picture. We rate ourselves to deliver a pretty good hospitality experience, and we feel like, again, it comes back to places that have sort of inspired us, like Little Creatures in Frio. I think people resonate with having an experience at the source of whatever it is that they're enjoying. So for decades, people who have gone to Perth and come back to Melbourne just rave about Frio and Little Creatures there. And you can't go to Perth without visiting it.
No.
And the pale ale there that you have, the folklore would tell you is the best version of that.
Yeah, it's just halo. Different.
Yeah, and it is different, regardless of whether it's scientifically or technically different. Mm-hmm. It's different because you're in the vibe, and you can see the tanks, and you can meet the brewer, and you can taste, you can touch the ingredients, you can smell the hops, and so it is different. And that experience is what resonates with people, and we believe is what makes people go into bottle shop potentially and choose our beer over someone else's. So so Moorabbin is an extension of that. It's a much more hospitality play than it is a brewing play down there. So the brewery is a 12-hectare brew house with four or five serving tanks and four or five fermenters.
But you're still brewing there.
We will be, absolutely. Right. So, but it's to brew some fun stuff, kind of... do lots of different things. There'll be, I mean, we've set a pretty cracking pace with different beers as it is. Like we're trying to, in some ways, slow that down a little bit just from a coping with it from a sales and marketing point of view.
Yes.
But down there will be about that. There'll be a new beer on each week, and there'll be different styles that we haven't tried before probably. And there'll be stuff that's unique that only gets sold there, and other stuff that we might sell here in Collingwood as well. It's a sort of experimental type set up for the brewery down there, and then it's a big European in style beer hall in an industrial setting, like similar to this, and it'll be similar enough that you know that it's us, but different enough that it's not a cookie cutter. And one thing that we're really excited about down there is it's got a big function room as well, which we haven't had here. This area that we're sitting in at the moment was going to be a function room until we ran out of money for this fit out. and we decided it's probably easier just to deck it like the rest of this area. But we've always wanted it to be a small function room, and down there will be a function room on the sort of scale that's capable of you know, mid-sized weddings corporate staff.
Wow.
And we think that's going to be really valuable down there, because it's an interesting area with quite a bit of residential around it, but also some light industrial. But then there's some corporate stuff down there. Coca-Cola's got a head office down there. There's some corporate stuff as well, which we think is an opportunity for us.
Must make you feel pretty proud to open a new venue after what you've been through in the last 12 months.
Yeah, it does. It does. And it was touch and go there for a while. Mm. It was supposed to open in July last year. And we actually gave the go ahead to the builders on a Friday in March, might have been the 20th. And then on the Monday, we called it all off.
Yeah.
And it was a long road navigating, you know, whether it was going to be possible at one point there towards the end of last year. So to have it now almost built and ready to open, yeah, it's a massively proud moment for us for sure, and we're really excited about it.
Is there a couple of questions before I let you go? As I just said, I've thought of another question. Is there something that you want to take out of last year for yourself that you want to keep that maybe you weren't doing before?
I think really when I mentioned earlier that people went through the pandemic at different stages and the various levels of roller coasters of emotions and that sort of thing, I think if anything, it gave me a real strong belief that I need to be aware of where everyone's at emotionally at any given stage. I think sometimes you sort of take for granted, you know, that everyone's right up for doing whatever big event you've got on the next week, or they're right up for whatever. Mm-hmm. There's times when people are battling a bit and they need a bit of love rather than just rolling out the next thing. And I think it was just highlighted by the fact that everybody had such a different experience of last year. That was so unique to each individual. Mm. They all had different family situations, different financial situations, different pressures at different times. And I think that's something we always need to be aware of, and I'm going to be more aware of moving forward than probably I was before last year.
Mm-hmm. That's a good insight. My last question to you, Justin, is what are you looking forward to both professionally and personally in 2021?
Personally, I'm looking forward to no homeschooling for my son this year, which is good because that was a battle. Look, we're really excited about Moorabbin. We're really excited also about some optimism finally after continually hearing for 12 months about all the stuff we can't do.
Mm-hmm.
We can now start looking at things that we can do, and events are a big part of that within the venues. Partnerships, increasing, rejoining SCARF on our journey with them and getting some events happening with them.
Mm-hmm.
Collingwood Brewery Trail that you mentioned earlier is a sort of a touristy walking trail that we've put together with Molly Rose and Fixation, The Mill and Bodrigi, which is launching this coming Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just continuing to grow the brand and get out there and try and resonate with Melbourne as much as we can.
Yeah. Justin, what's the best way that people can find out about Stomping Ground and with yourself as well, if you want to?
Stompingground.beer is the best place to find out what we're up to. All the social media handles are on there. And you can keep an eye on what's going on with the build in Moorabbin through there as well.
Yep.
With the opening date looking like end of May, early June, we'll see how we go. or you can come and see us here or at the airport when you're on your way in or out of Melbourne or at down at Moorabbin once that gets open as well.
Happy days. Justin Joyner from Stomping Ground, thank you so much.
No worries. Thanks, Sean. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again for tuning in to another episode of Principle of Hospitality, the podcast. We hope you really enjoyed this episode. Please comment, like, and share this podcast with your friends in the industry. We're making this content with the industry in mind, so we'd really appreciate you sharing along with those that you care about in the industry. Thanks as well to our sponsor, Chef's Hat, the largest family-owned and operated hospitality supplier in Australia. They strive to inspire cooks, chefs, bakers, and bartenders to deliver the best product with the best tools every day. We're so proud to partner with them. That's where the industry shops. And if you don't know us at Poe, Sash, my co-founder from Principal Design, has one of the best design agencies in Australia. So if you're looking for anything around strategy, branding, digital design, and graphic design, then you can find them at principaldesign.com.au and myself at Open Pantry Consulting for anything to do with hospitality operations, strategy, and recruitment. Thanks so much for tuning in. Thanks to Chef's Hat for supporting us. And until next time, stay safe. Cheers. Thank you.